Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CT&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, as you can see, I've been upgraded to the main studio today. The tech gremlins have eaten my library, so we have people working on that. Now, we're a week away from the election, possibly one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime. Now, I know they always say that, but normally that's not true. It really doesn't make any difference if it's Obama or whoever that other guy was. I've forgotten his name already. You know, a lot of the time it's just uniparty versus uniparty, but this time it really does matter. On one hand, you've got a man who could save Western civilization against a low IQ puppet who would start World War III if they told it to or put it on the teleprompter. So what I really need in these nail-biting last few days before the election is I need an injection of optimism. And for that, we've reached out to fan favourite Dr. Steve Turley. Welcome back to Brokenomics.
Dan, it's an honor. It's great to be with kindred spirits here. I'll try to be as optimistic as I can.
Well, how is the optimism going? I mean, what are your optimism levels going into this?
Well, Dan, I was raised in a middle class neighborhood with no. that's been Kamala's stock answer for anything she's asked.
Funny because we've just been through an election where the guy, every single question was, my dad was a tool maker. So I know what you're going through.
Yeah, they must have the same advisors, the advisor class. It's just they're same on both sides of the pond. Yeah, I think there is cautious optimism. There is definitely a sense among the right here that this may be it. We're Kamala looks like she's collapsing. All the indicators certainly seem to suggest that. But people are very worried. We were talking before the interview. Our elections are basically third world. I mean, that's an insult to the third world, to be honest with you. Our elections, they come down to the different states. Each state is in charge of their own elections. So Florida always wraps up the results within basically an hour or two after the polls close. Texas always gives you the results. Tennessee, North Carolina, you name it. It's always those, you know, states like Georgia, these swing states, as we call them, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Oh, we'll know in 3 days, 4 days after the election. And it really does reek of corruption for a lot of people. So there's a lot of concern there. We're all still kind of traumatized from 2020 when Trump almost pulled it off. It came within 40,000 votes of winning that election. And it was just so clearly the establishment just united against him. Talk about election interference all the way through. And then that same establishment, particularly the legacy media, tells us, oh, no, it's the most pristine election ever to have taken place in the history of humanity. So I think there's still a lot of trauma that's getting worked out. It's kind of our Vietnam of elections. You know, we're still trying to get over those ghosts. But all the indicators show Trump is stronger than he has ever been, either in 2016 or 2020, and the Democrat is weaker than they've ever been.
Well, I mean, it's probably no coincidence that the swing states are the ones that take the longest to count. I'm sure that's not, that's not happenstance. I think if this was a normal election, everything I'm seeing tells me that Trump would absolutely romp home. But, of course, the question is, can he win by greater than the margin that they can fortify?
There you go. The margin of fraud, as we call it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I look at some things and I think it's a deadlock. He's definitely going to win. And then I listen to people like, I don't say Mike Benz, who looks a lot at the security state. And I think, but they cannot let him. So, right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, how much protection is there in the system against, you know, just sheer vote power? I mean, how much can they really do if they need to?
The whole system is obfuscated by design. You can't audit it. You can't canvass the votes, as we say. The system is designed to be confusing, like our tax systems. Unfortunately, Benz is pressing on a soft spot in our elections. you would hope that there's still, at least at the state level, because that's what's running this. It's not the federal governments, the state governments, that there's still enough integrity there for this to be a fair and free election, basically. You know, there's still going to be a bunch of cheating there, no question. And I'm in right outside of Philly, and Philly's notorious for, you know, having 105% turnout in some districts, you know. So
that is impressive now, civil engagement, that is.
It's very impressive. My late grandparents didn't know they voted for Obama, you know. So, yeah, right. It's again, though, one of the things we do have to we'll bring the optimism back. We have to protect ourselves from is what we call doomerism. What I like to say is stop dooming about it and do something about it. It's very American, right? You find a little jingle there. Stop dooming about it. Start doing something about it.
I mean,
contact your local officials and the like. Make sure they're doing whatever they possibly can to secure the democratic integrity of this election. Because again, to be honest with you, Dan, I just got to tell you, I don't know how Kamala can win legitimately in the eyes of.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking to 80 million people right now. They're just no matter what, they could blame. They can blame Trump's loss on Jack Smith and our the prosecution and the lawfare. They can blame it on the way the media has been covering up for Kamala. They can blame it on all kind. They can blame it on just, you know, blatant nefarious forces and behind the polling in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. They can blame it on all kinds of things. That Democrats can't win, it seems to me, a legitimate election anymore. This is unfortunately the toll of 2020. That's still, it's a scar that's going to be with us for a long time.
Yeah. So, well, actually, I mean, on that, they might be doing us a favor, because if this was a normal election, a lot of people might feel that they don't need to do their best, but they don't need to go out and vote because it's such a lock for Trump. Whereas raising this ambiguity and everybody knowing that they need to vote so strong that it goes beyond the margin of fortification, it could actually end up rebounding in our favor. I mean, that's a possibility.
It seems to be happening with the early voting. The Republicans are crushing it. We've never seen early voting numbers like this. Never. I mean, they're ahead in North Carolina. Republicans are never ahead in early voting. Republicans are election day civic duty voters. They've been that way for decades. They're ahead in Arizona. They're ahead in Georgia. They're ahead in North Carolina.
What's driving that then? Is that because of there's always election day shenanigans? I mean, I remember things like sending the wrong size ballot papers out to, coincidentally, only Republican voting areas so that they wouldn't run through the, you know, the automatic counting machines, doing other things, you know, not giving the right power supply to the voting machines in Republican only areas by coincidence. So that there was long queues. And is it Republicans are sort of wising up to, they know that they are actively going to be disenfranchised and therefore they need to pull every lever?
Yes. Yeah. I think you said it perfectly. Yeah. I think we've been waiting for this for 4 years. We've been waiting for this moment for 4 years. We knew Trump was going to come back for a third go. We knew this was going to be Trump 2.0. And they've been galvanized. And now Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law, she's in charge of the Republican National Committee, along with Mike Whatley, who was instrumental in turning the Republican Party into a supermajority in North Carolina. He's from the North Carolina Republican Party. He's brilliant. I think they're up to it. Again, we'll see how it plays out. But right now, as we speak, Republicans are crushing early voting like never before. And I just think it's been this get out the vote effort, this voter registration effort, and also getting out what we call low propensity to no propensity voters. So voters who didn't vote, who only voted in one of the last four elections, they're called low propensity, and voters that didn't vote in any of the last four elections are called no propensity, low prop and no prop. And we're finding they're coming out in spades for early voting. That comes through the voter registration efforts and ballot chasing and all that. Yeah. And they're voting overwhelmingly Republican. Very similar. We'll talk about, I'm sure, very similar to the Brexit vote, where low prop and no prop voters came out in mass to vote for that referendum.
I mean, I've seen a number of clips at this point of these sort of vox pops on the streets of black men being asked which way they're going to vote. And now, of course, historically, they've always gone very heavily Democrat. And to a man, they're going, there's no way I'm letting that woman be president.
Yeah, it's stunning. Yeah. And it's gotten so bad now that they're not blaming race anymore. Now they're deferring back to sex. They're deferring back to gender.
Now,
right. So it's men who I love. Who was it who said it? I forget the other day. Men are worried about strong, independent women who are seeking power. And so these men are becoming fascists. Yeah, I think this is Mika Brzezinski from MSNBC. These men are becoming fascists. They're embracing fascism to stop these strong, independent women from taking power. And I'm thinking, you mean like Georgia Maloney? You mean like Marine Le Pen? Independent women, strong independent women seeking power, they can't be called fascists, Mika? Do I need to actually bring back to you the headlines that were greeting Georgia Maloney and Marine Le Pen, or the leader of the AFD, the Alternative for Deutschland?
Oh, yes.
Dutch
Farmers Party. I mean, yeah, there's a whole bunch of them, isn't there? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They have strong females leading them, but who are fascists. In the end, they just have no intellectual credibility whatsoever at this point.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're here to talk about your book, which is excellent, by the way. We are definitely coming to that. But I just want to catch up on a couple of bits that have happened since we last spoke. I mean, the big political events has been many. But I mean, I think we'd probably focus on things like J.D. Vance coming on board, the candidate switching to Kamala, a couple of assassinations. There's also a UK election, but boring. We talk about that another time.
You were on the front line. The change of that, man. You even coined the term.
We did what we could on that one. Where do we start? I mean, what do you want to go with there? J.D. Vance, I think, was the first, wasn't it? No, the assassination was first, wasn't it? By a day.
That's right. So that was July 13th. So that would have been about a week before he chose J.D. Vance, because it was on a Saturday, and they had the Republican convention that following week.
What do you make of Vance then? I mean, what's your assessment of that pick?
Vance is huge. It's Vance has solidified the fact that the Republican Party is now officially our reform party. So Trump, in many ways, is a third party candidate, right? Third party candidate who took over a major party. Yes. So it'd be something akin to Farage taking over the Tories and just totally revamping them. The Republicans have fought tooth and nail all these 8 years for this. They were hoping Trump was a one and done. He was a fluke. J.D. Vance is now, especially after the VP debate where he demolished Tim Walz, who just ended up looking like a cartoon character up there. He has now solidified the future of the Republican Party as a MAGA party, as our reform party.
That MAGA will outlive Trump.
Absolutely, that's what my book's all about. Absolutely, because we have a lot of that. We owe over to you because of the very similar processes that animated Brexit and that will continue to animate our politics. Granted. I like to tell our audience, if you're worried about globalism and globalists and liberals and so forth, I'm sorry, you got to look in the mirror. We are it for places like Russia or China or India or Turkey. Liberal globalism is a foreign invader. You know, they're trying to take over their country, and so they can galvanize their people and push it back, almost like, you know, Attila the Hun threat or something akin to that. For us, although you have a little bit of that with the bullies in Brussels, for us, it's a civil war. These guys are entrenched in all of our cultural institutions. They have all the levers of power. And it's going to take time to literally exorcise this from our society. But the argument I try to make, and I think J.D. Vance would be a perfect embodiment of it, is that these are just you know, history moves like a tide in the ocean, and we're on a raft, and we can kind of move around and rearrange the chairs in all kinds of ways, but we're still moving. And what I try to do is look at the big picture trends to show we're moving in a direction that I think all of us would say is the direction of sanity.
I don't know if you use the word, if you use those words, you describe it like a tide in the book. I can't remember, but that is very much the kind of message that you're getting across, that there is that sort of groundswell that is happening. So yes, we must come to that, but also very quickly, Kamala. What
what do you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, the most probably the most fabricated public figure on the planet right now. I mean, what do you say? When she was in law, when she was a district attorney, the joke was in California that if you were a defense attorney and you found out you were going up against Kamala Harris in the prosecution, you high-fived your client, said, "We got this." She was known all across the Western legal system as one of the stupidest morons up there. And she proves it every day. She proves it. You just compare her mind to someone like a J.D. Vance. And I mean, it's just, I mean, there's, I don't know, what do you even say about it? It's obviously she has a really hard time being in front of a camera, being in front of people, being in front of us, a puffball interviewer. I mean, it's just,
yes.
Yeah, it's bizarre. But,
is it possible that DEI got her all the way to running for president? Is that possible?
It is possible, and you have about 43-45% of our population ready to reward that because they hate the other side so much. They've learned to hate the MAGA side so much. And again, it's similar dynamics I know are going across the pond. I have to say, on our side, I have to say, because of the strength of religiosity and traditional Christianity on our side, there's still an empathy that I see for people on the left. I mean, you see it even just the way we stand up for free speech. No, go ahead, say your piece, but allow me to say mine, and let's let the best argument win. I think this is why Elon Musk has been coming over and Jordan Peterson have been coming over to our side. But their side is just animated with this radical perspectivalism that says, if you do not comport to our way of thinking, you, ironically, are a heretic. Yes. And heretics must be punished. They must be burned. Hence, cancel culture. It's a form of secular excommunication.
And there is a level up from there, isn't there? I've got to get your take on the assassination. You have a touching anecdote, I think, at the end of the book. But I get the impression most of this book was written by the time the assassination had taken place. But you've got a touching story at the end, which I won't spoil for people. What was your take on? Well, what are now two assassination attempts?
Yeah, two assassination attempts. Yeah. We've all been saying it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when somebody would try it. We've all been saying that because the rhetoric against Trump is so over the top. I think the latest article, was it from The Atlantic or The New Yorker? It was the headline, "Trump sounds like Hitler, Mussolini, and Mao all rolled up in one." And everyone just started to lie. It was one of the most mocked, you know. So we've graduated from Trump as Hitler to Trump as Mussolini to Trump as Mao to now let's just throw them all together, you know.
And yeah, stick Genghis Khan in there cocktail. As well. Why not? Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the most famous moral dilemmas that we have in hypothetical ethics is, you know, if you could have taken Hitler out, would you have? And 99% of people say, sure, yeah. Well, yeah. There you go. You know, this kid crook tried to, ironic last name, tried to take him out. And the radical incompetence, I mean, somebody actually described it as apocalyptic incompetence on the part of the Secret Service, does seem to suggest a kind of intentional neglect. That's how Jack Posobiec puts it in his book. He just wrote a book on the shooting.
You could view it as sort of this stochastic terrorism term that the left sort of originally engendered. You can say, okay, well, on one hand, they're creating a pool of likely shooters with their media appearance. Now, they know that in any large population, and you've got, you know, 350 million people to pick from, you run that sort of rhetoric, you are going to generate naturally a number of people who want to take that shot. And the only thing you need to add to that is opportunity. And it is quite clear that opportunities are being left open in order for that to happen. And, you know, this story has gone very quiet, like a lot of these things do. Yeah. I mean, the Las Vegas shooter and a whole bunch of other ones, they've gone very quiet. And Trump seems to go very quiet on it himself. But I don't think missing a bullet by a quarter of an inch is the sort of thing that you just forget about after a few months. I hope that he's going to bring the hammer down on the deep state and the mechanisms that the liberals are running the moment he comes into power.
With him and with Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy Jr. was one of the first people he talked to afterward. I think that was it. That's when they made the decision to realign, create a populist alignment between the two. And Elon Musk as well. Elon's already joking. You know, I remember when I took over Twitter, I fired 80% of the workforce there. We could do the same thing in D.C. Yeah, exactly. And it's so much better
now. That would be superb. I mean, one of the guys said to me here, he says, do you think maybe we're doing too many segments on Trump and Elon? And I said to him, well, yeah, but if this was 48 B.C., and we had a podcast then, would you be complaining that we're doing too many segments about Pompey and Caesar and Mark Antony? You've got to go with the great men of the time, haven't you? I mean, that's the fascinating stuff.
It's what I think Patrick Deneen refers to as aristopopulism. He draws from Aristotle on that. Aristotle said you can have an oligarchy that rules for its own values, interests, concerns, and completely disregards and dismisses the people, this sort of Marie Antoinette sort of thing. Let them eat cake, right? Or on the other hand, you can have a total mass, you know, French Revolution uprising, democracy in its ultimate sense, where it's just mob rule. What you want is a balance. You want an aristopopulism. You want, and again, the best of when British society is at its best, this is what you guys do like no one else. You have an aristocracy that puts into reality, that uses their power and their influence to make a reality the values and interests and concerns of the people who do not have the means to do it themselves. And when you have an aristopopulism like that, Aristotle says you have the basis for a flourishing society. And I think that's what these guys represent.
You want competing tendencies amongst the elites, because like you said, if it's not going to be amongst the elites, that circulation of power, it's going to have to be the full French Revolution. It's going to have to be that full undoing of a civilization, which could be quite cathartic at this point, but it would also be there'd be a lot of drama that went along with it.
You said it, I did it.
You said it. You probably don't want to go there. So you want these sort of competing tensions in the elites. But we've had for decades now a system where the system has been so predictable and so uniform that we've had a class of elites who are all basically aligned interest. And that's simply by virtue of the fact that you would not be an elite if you did not compete very well in this stable environment.
That's exactly right.
So you've got this but now we've got a new elite emerging. Elon is probably the best example of that. Somebody who does not adhere to the old model. And there's a bunch of others. I mean, the former PayPal guys, you know, the David Sachs and the
Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel, that's the one. You're getting all of these characters emerging. It looks like they're not happy having all of this sort of power and money, but no sort of political influence. And they're going to try and push through one way or another.
And to close the loop on that, J.D. Vance embodies that, because J.D. Vance made his money with Peter Thiel. So he brings together Appalachian working class with the new tech right that's rising up, these kind of anti-Silicon Valley techies like Elon Musk, like Peter Thiel, like Vivek Ramaswamy and so forth. And no one embodies the sort of aristopopulist movement like J.D. Vance.
Yeah. So, Steve, it was so good to catch up, but we must move on to your book, because I got this over the weekend. It's a great read. There are many things I like about it, the message, obviously, but I also like the fact that it gets to the point It delivers its point, and it doesn't run on endlessly. What is it? Something like 150 pages. I'll tell you, the amount of books I read these days, they're sort of 300 pages long, and the second half is all filler. You didn't do that. You made your point, and you got it done. So I really appreciate that, if nothing else.
Thank
but
you.
Let's jump into some of the points you're making there, because you start off in the first chapter, the first part of the book, talking about the rise of liberalism. So what is it about liberalism that makes it so incompatible with a decent functioning society? And was it always like that? How did we get into this situation?
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.